Podcast. I'm Amy Walter. I originally asked my guest today, Michael Podhorser, to come on to talk about voter demographics. Mike was a longtime political director for the AFL-CIO. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for American Politics, and he writes a Substack called Weekend Reading, which, by the way, I recommend if you'd like to sign up for it. He's been one of the pioneers in Democratic circles using data and analytics to inform campaign strategy. But soon after I invited him on, well, there was that debate and Joe Biden's terrible performance, and the entire presidential race took a sharp turn. So we're going to start there. And then later on, we'll get into some of his big picture thoughts on horse race polling, education polarization, and what he sees as the real source of our political divides. And by the way, since news is moving fast, we recorded this conversation on Tuesday, July 9th at 2 p.m. Hi, Mike Podhorser. How are you?
Good. How are you, Amy Walter?
I am quite well. Let's just jump right into this. Originally, we had booked you to talk about demographics, voter demographics, specifically your response to a show we had previously about the role that education plays in voting behavior. And then something kind of big happened, Mike, which was this debate. And what I want to start by asking you is not to predict what's going to happen next or anything like that, but are Democrats rightly panicked about Biden continuing on and where this race is today?
So I think that everybody is understandably panicked because the debate performance and the follow-up interview with George Stephanopoulos fell well below expectations. And I think revealed that, especially after the State of the Union, that perhaps Democrats had, if you will, priced in too much his unpopularity, and that going into the debate, his age was seen as one of his biggest negatives. And so this is about sort of the worst kind of thing to have happened, because they've been trying for 6 months to put this issue to the side.
Yeah.
And as you know, I don't really think of myself as a capital D Democrat. I think that especially in this election year, coming out of the labor movement, that the stakes are much, much bigger than whether a Democrat or a Republican is elected, in the sense we might have thought about this 15 or 20 years ago. They're hoping for a second American Revolution. And so I think structurally, the election hasn't changed, in the sense that this was always going to be, as was 22 and 20 and 18, a question of whether or not voters want to see their vote as being protection against Trump and MAGA or not.
Mm-hmm.
And if the election is in October, the long time between now and October, if the election is a referendum on that second American Revolution, I think almost any Democrat would win, or more precisely, Trump would lose. To the extent that it's a referendum on Biden and the Democrats, they're most likely going to lose.
Yeah.
And what changes in because of the debate is not really a kind of the same kind of thing that we think about when we think about other, say, congressional race or something like that. What matters is the extent to which it improved or reduced the chances that the election is about Trump and MAGA or it's about Biden. And that's why this was, I think, particularly damaging, because it makes a lot of people focus more on the risks of Biden. But to be clear, whether he is on the ballot in November or someone else's, it will be decided by whether or not the people who in 2020 and in many states in 22 came out to protect their abortion, to protect their health care, to do all of those things, decide that's what they need to do again.
So I guess that's the fundamental question then, Mike, which is if the goal is to keep the focus on Donald Trump, can Biden do that? I mean, again, it's only July, you're right. We've got a ways to go before October. But that's, to me, the bigger question swirling around among Democrats, whether it's the vice president or anybody else, that becomes the more important distinction.
Well, I think that this has made it much more difficult for the Biden campaign to keep the focus on what Trump would mean if he's returned to office. I think that there's a sort of a kind of flaw in, and I think we'll probably come back to this a couple of times, of trying to analyze this election and the three before it using the kind of heuristics and, common sense that worked really well before it. And I think here the big difference is that the sort of gap there is that we have, as you, I think, championed, right? You have all of these double haters and you have the MED voters, right? And given what people already know about both of them, they are not really going to be persuaded by what either candidate says, right? The problem with a double hater or meh electorate is that it's disarmed what both campaigns are saying about the other to a great extent, right? Because they don't really like either of them and they don't trust them, right? It's a big part of why we have this like faux mystery of why Biden can't convince anyone that they have a great economy right now, right? If you don't, especially for millennials and Gen Z, who are obviously the key here, right? Their lives since the Great Recession have been pretty bad. And they don't believe that politicians and politics can help them.
So even if there were a younger, more dynamic candidate who was president, or let's just say a younger, more dynamic Democratic president, your argument is that person would still have these challenges with younger voters because of the challenge of being an incumbent at a time when institutions are so mistrusted. So the cynicism and the frustration is driving this as much as age.
Yeah, probably not to as extreme an extent as it is right now. I think, a way to think about it, it's really interesting because after the debate of performance, and as every time a new poll comes out that has Trump ahead by more, it's insufficient attention is paid to the fact that all or almost all of that widened margin comes from people not being willing to commit to Biden or choosing a third party, right?
That's right. They're not going right. to Trump. Right. They're parking themselves in a different category.
Basically, and in a way that, again, defies listening to everybody narrate noise every day. If you go back to 2019, it's almost a flatline approval of Trump, right? Through all of it. That's the number of people in America who approve of who he is, what he does, his agenda, and all of that, right? And so a more subtle aspect of sort of the age of the candidate issue and of the dilemma the Democrats have in all of this is that, as you know, because I've heard other guests on you write about this well, that young voters in particular have so little confidence in current institutions, they just want to burn things down, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's one candidate who wants to burn things down, except it's burning their houses down. And so it's not like, even though he's trying to completely discredit the system and say he's going to burn it all down, they understand that that means losing their right to an abortion or their health care or those things, which is why Biden had a 20-point margin in 2020, right? Their young voters understand that's not what they want to see rise out of the ashes after the country's burned down, right? On the other hand, two-party, the other choice, is someone who's saying this is exactly about, you know, the soul of America or however you're going to define it, but saying that his commitment to this fight is to preserve exactly the America that those young people are completely dissatisfied with.
Right. So protecting the status quo may be comfortable for some people.
Right.
Right. And it's what you hear a lot from commentators. But if you're talking to younger people, the status quo has been inadequate for quite a long time.
And so that's why they're so, if you from focus groups or anywhere, they're so legitimately grumpy about the whole thing. Right. I mean, that neither party is coming close to talking to their actual lives or concerns. And so once again, they have to choose between reverting back to an America they don't think's great or sticking with one that's not much better.
So then let me ask you about this dynamic, though. If the issue really is the alienation of these anti-Trump or anti-MAGA voters from just the Democratic Party writ large, why do you think that Democratic candidates, especially we're seeing some of these polls in places where you have Democratic incumbents like Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or Nevada, where the Democratic candidate is actually, I mean, they're not like super popular, but they're not unpopular, where they're getting decent margins from younger voters, where they're doing a heck of a lot better than Biden against, granted, a lesser known Republican. So that suggests to me that there's something about Biden himself, not just about this broader theme that you're talking about.
No, it's both, right? But one of the things that also plays into it, because but it turns out that not every problem that Democrats like have is just shooting themselves in the foot, right? That if you dig into that difference between that gets a lot of attention between the Senate Democratic candidates and Biden in those states, and as you say, it's really about the younger people in those states, and then you look at where they get their information on TikTok, YouTube, and so on. Biden's getting crushed there, right? If you're in those information and ecosystems, you're seeing a lot of really hard-hitting stuff about Biden, probably more than, say, Jackie Rosen.
Not seeing necessarily more positive stuff about Jackie Rosen. You're just not seeing negative stuff about her, is it?
Right. People don't know why to hate her, you know, and in the way they do with Biden. And so I think that the way the senators are doing sort of reflects a kind of 2022 balance of power in those states. But TikTok has just been brutal for Biden.
So how then, Mike, you work a lot with progressive groups and others about, you know, trying to figure out how to make this election about the stakes of this election. How do Democrats do that? How do progressives do that? How does the Biden campaign do that when right now the frenzy about Biden himself is as high as it is? And some of the things we thought were going to be part of the discussion by now, Mike, like the January 6th trial or the sentencing in New York, all of those have been pushed aside.
Well, I think saying that the January 6th stuff was pushed aside is amazing kind of understatement. And I think reveals something that should just be said directly, which is that we have six justices on the Supreme Court who are as much political players as Mitch McConnell and the Republican caucus. In December of last year, Jack Smith asked that set of nine justices to hear immunity. They didn't do it. It went forward. The District Court of Appeals basically slammed it down bipartisan. And the trial was set to start March 4th, right? February 28th, the Supreme Court swept in, took Trump's appeal, sat on it till July 1st, providing him de facto immunity and preventing everyday Americans from sitting to hold Trump accountable for what we all saw with our own eyes 4 years ago, right? And so I think we have to really come to terms with the fact that since Bush v. Gore, the nominees of the Republican Party have engaged in putting their thumb on every election in every way they can, right? And in really important ways that aren't about Trump, right? That Citizens United, right? Now campaigns cost literally twice as much in real dollars as before. Changes who has power and a voice in the election and doesn't. The Rucho gerrymandering cases, right? In 2012, Democrats won a majority of the vote in the House and were something like 20 votes short because of the gerrymandering they allowed. In 2022, they directly, those justices gave them Republicans four seats, right? There's a hand at work that's invisible only to people who don't want to see it. And that's, so I think that's a big part of it. And that's the struggle we're in.
Your point is, it's not just that Democrats, Biden, is up against the Trump campaign, but there are other forces that make it difficult to make that case. Right. But then from a purely campaign perspective, Mike, how does that become part of the message? In other words, we heard a lot in 2016 about these Republican voters who weren't really sold on Donald Trump. They were like, I don't know, but the message came across, do it for the Supreme Court, right? Do it so that we can, you may not like him, but at least it will keep the court in the right place. I mean, is that the kind of thing that Democrats should be talking about?
Oh, absolutely, and more. But I think it's also about what I call civil society, that which includes the media, that there's a big part of what's gone wrong in this country is that we sort of have a learned helplessness that it's up to the Democrats to stop all this, as opposed to all of us, regardless of any kind of partisan affiliation. And if you think, and this is just one example, but if you think about the episode with kids in cages, right? There was a huge outpouring of civil society almost immediately, religious leaders, corporate leaders, and so on, right? The question is whether before the election that those same kind of forces are clear with the constituencies that they have credibility with, that there's that much at stake again. And I take great heart from what just happened in France, right? Where everybody was saying after the EU elections that Le Pen and the far right were going to be swept into a majority in France. And the left and center came together because they were against that and won. And it's the same pretty much everywhere. It has to be beyond partisanship.
The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report team. It's our way of sharing the questions we love to ask and the conversations we enjoy having behind the scenes. If you'd like to explore more of what we have to offer, consider subscribing
at cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Oddier listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers.
I want to go into some of the things you have written about for a long time now in Weekend Reading. And for those of you listening, if you are not subscribed to his Substack, you should be. A lot of really smart and insightful stuff in there. But one thing you've long talked about is something you called the mad pole disease. And I want you to sort of talk about that and explain how you think we should be looking at all the data that's coming at us right now.
So what I call mad pole disease, which I used sort of christened over the summer after the first New York Times poll had everybody looking for assisted suicide, is that there are things that polling can tell you with some confidence, and there are things that it can't. And one of the things it can't tell you, because you already know it, is that who wins the Electoral College will come down almost certainly to elections that are won or lost by less than one percentage point in exactly the states we know that's going to happen. Yep. And so to take the temperature every day and, months and months out, it's like trying to find atomic particles with a magnifying glass when you need a microscope, right? And so you are so desperate for some kind of oracular confidence that you keep going back to a tool that just can't do it. And when you think about the last three elections, and the polls the day before the elections or the week before, the final polls that folks did, which literally now with early voting is after tens of millions of Americans have actually cast their ballots. And in none of the last three elections were the major states all called correctly, right? And that's the week of, right? And now people, to think that you can look at a horse race poll and it's doing anything other than distracting you from changing the result is really foolish. But the other part of it that I think is problematic is that implicitly, if you believe that a poll taken today can tell you what will happen tomorrow, then you're also telling yourself that you don't think what you do between today and tomorrow matters.
Right.
That if the election is going to in Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, wherever, is as close as it's been for the last couple cycles, it's going to matter more what the margin of your effort is than what the margin of error in the poll is. And you just makes you neurotic and paralyzed.
So your advice then is to do what? Is just to just accept that it's going to be a really close race and just, you need to do, if you're a Democrat, do what you need to do. If you're a Republican, you do what you need to do. Yeah. And then.
Yeah. It's we're literally running the same election for the fourth time. Right.
You really do think this is really the exact same election.
I mean, it won't necessarily end up the same way, but it's the same array of consequences. And the issue is always how clearly voters see that on election day.
Let's talk about the one thing we did originally brought you on to talk about, which is, the degree to which those of us who cover politics really want to understand voters. And so we put them in these nice little categories because they make us feel comfortable, right? So we like talking about suburban moms and soccer dads and all these different groups because they give us some structure in a political world that feels so unstructured. And so when this divide really became clear in 2016, that people especially white voters, who had a four-year college degree, were voting differently than white voters without, we said, ah, that's it. That's the difference in politics, whether you have whether you have that four-year degree or whether you don't. And your point has long been, well, that's fine, but that's not telling us the whole story. So tell us how, one, how you see this divide, what it really is telling us, and two, how we should think about our electorate. We talk about it as being polarized. We talk about the election as being super, super close. You know, it's a fraction of an inch, whether one side wins or the other. And yet, who those people are who are deciding our elections becomes something we are all obsessed with. So how do you make sense of it?
So here's where being a campaign practitioner, as opposed to an academic or someone trying to get a handle on it the way you just described, really informs what I'm saying, which is that if I'm running, say, for the sake of this conversation, say the presidential campaign, Biden's campaign manager, I don't get bonus points for picking up more Hispanic voters. I don't lose points for having more white college voters. My strategy is to get Biden voters to vote. And I'm really indifferent to what category others have put them in, except to the extent that there's something about that category, and only a few of them, this is true, suggests how we might communicate with them.
Yeah.
But in terms of thinking about how to get to 50 plus one, it doesn't matter what color eyes they have. It doesn't matter whether they have a degree. Every vote counts the same. And so what a campaign tries to do is identify the people who are going to support you no matter what, make sure they go, and then look, cluster the rest of the electorate around the things they either agree with you on or that they strongly disagree with the other candidate. And because in this exercise, you're counting things, you can be fooled into thinking that the number of people who say don't like Trump and are white non-college are white non-college and therefore don't like Trump. And that's where, like, the causality gets backwards, right? The percentage of people who are voting for Trump who are white non-college is downstream from people in their independent judgment liking or not liking Donald Trump, and then counting how many of them are in each educational bucket. And what people really don't intuit, because there's never any geographic breakdown of any of these demographic categories, is that in 2020, Joe Biden did better with white non-college voters in blue states than he did with white college voters in red states. And that there's no, like, internal consistency to the voting in these, in the, you know, in the privileged demographic categories. And because of the kind of just, like, need to hold on to those categories, many things that should be obvious to people, like, just keep surprising them, right? So if to stick with the white college and white non-college, right? And so remember, once everyone thought, oh, white non-college is going to be terrible, end of the world, all of that, right? One of the things that is happening in every one of the demographic categories is, sad to say, some people are aging out of the electorate, and they tend to be much more Republican and conservative. And there are other people in the same demographic category who are aging into the electorate, and they're much more likely to think women have a right to choose and to think all of those things. So by just insisting that it's all education, you have no grip on why the bottom didn't fall out after Clinton with white non-college voters, for example. Right? Because you're replacing, you know, coal miners with baristas, right? Right, that's just happening all, and you're just willfully ignoring the dynamics in the country.
Right. So your point being, if we, some of it is the lack of imagination. So we think of white non-college, and you're right, you think of coal miners and guys on an assembly line, usually men. You don't think about the people who are maybe service workers or doing other jobs that don't require,
right,
or they don't have a four-year degree, but they're not, they don't have the same ideology.
Right.
They don't have the same priorities as those other voters. And at the same time, I mean, the point that some, especially in academia, have made is that there is something about the process of going through the four-year college system and the ways in which it shapes the values of the people that go into it, right? And that those people come out of college and they're in leadership and they set the values for the institutions, and then here we are, right? And that those values get more weight and more influence because they're the media and they're Hollywood and it's finance and all of the things that are really the biggest and most powerful institutions in the country.
So I'll make a small point and then the bigger one. The small point is that even going college, non-college, if you're just a youth education, misses the extent to which the caricature that you're talking about applies to postgraduate degree, that we know, right? We know from the fact that most surveys don't just ask college, non-college, they ask some high school, graduated high school, some college, BA, and that's just like an additional misdirecting simplification of what's actually going on.
Yeah, the college are pretty evenly divided. It's when you add the postgraduate that they are just off the charts in terms of ideology and identity.
Right.
With them.
But the other reason I think that these categories are so sticky and so like why like it's really a fun way to talk about all this is that it does two things. The first, both of them very bad. The first is that it lets you think in terms of avatars. So that when you say white non-college, I can't imagine that more than like 1% of the people listening to this didn't immediately think of a burly guy in a Midwestern diner, right? And not only is it inaccurate, it leads to a political discourse about what Democrats need to do, which imagines that the only way to do better with white non-college voters is to convince that burly guy in the diner to vote for Democrats and to take for granted that whatever it's going to be is what our prejudices are about what burly guys in diners actually want, rather than understanding like those baristas are a different category, or even in that diner, right, in Wisconsin. If you just pull the camera back a little, there's someone pouring that guy's coffee, right? And she's probably pretty upset about Dobbs, right? And that's another white non-college voter. And you pan back more, right, and you see the kids in the booth who still haven't had a permanent full-time job and don't think much of politics, but if someone in the group sort of says, oh my God, they're going to do a national abortion ban or something, they end up showing up. And that's why white non-college voters in those battleground states have not given the country to Trump.
Because your argument is the stakes have been made to those voters.
And because they're not all the burly guy.
Right, right. That the lens has been pulled back beyond the burly guys. And also that thinking in terms of just of how a certain candidate is going to appeal to that guy takes away the bigger picture, which is, no, how is the message going to relate to everybody in that diner?
Right. And you just want to come out of the diner with as many votes as possible. And again, you don't get bonus votes for bringing the burly guy on your side.
Mike, if not then education, what is this polarization in this country about? Why is our blue-red sort of hardened as it is? And where do we go from here? I mean, I know you think about this a lot. You talk about this a lot. But help us to understand, not just for this election, but thinking about the next few years.
So I think the fundamental divide in the United States is the same divide the country started with, that we have never achieved single nationness, right? We have a very strong federalist form of government that is completely ignored in all political discourse. The fact that people live in different states, behave differently, just isn't in the conversation, right? Even though, if you look at the data, it's immediately obvious. And for a brief period, relatively, from, say, the 30s through to the 60s or so, there was beginning to be a national identity coming out of the Depression and World War II and a shared challenge and so forth. But since the end of the Cold War, America, because it didn't really change the fundamental way we elect people or distribute federal power, is pretty much as sectionally divided as we were on the eve of the Civil War. Right? If you go to my Substack, you'll see lots of graphs that just show how the Democratic and Republican caucuses are as regionally concentrated as they were then or on the edge of the New Deal. You look at in terms of electoral college votes. Up until the New Deal, basically the red and blue states gave landslides to opposite party presidential candidates.
That's right.
And since, certainly since 2000, every election has about 30% of the people living in a state that gave one or the other candidate a 10-point victory or more, a lot more, right? That's the fundamental division. And when and it's not like a descriptive division, it's the animating division, because there have always been a contest in this country between the original theocratic conception of what government is for in the then Confederate, now red states, which is that we don't need to figure out what's right and wrong. The Bible tells us that. And the purpose of the government is to make sure that everybody follows those rules. And a revolutionary, although like certainly some shortcomings in 1776, liberal perspective that said that getting consensus or agreement in some way defined what the right or wrong approach would be, that everyone would be better off trying to figure out how to work together and find joint solutions. And it's not accidental. It's exactly the same geography. And it's deep because those two sections have completely different economic models, right? The red states are extractive, committed to a low-wage economy, anti-union, lots of support for evangelical churches and so on. Blue is about knowledge economy, innovation, global commerce, making sure everyone's educated, and is incredibly secular.
This has been wonderful. Any final thoughts, Mike?
Yeah. If I can actually come back, wrapping up, to come back to finish up on one thing about what's dividing us, right? I think that the polling and the sort of super savvy demographics mask what's totally obvious is dividing this country, right? Is it's like two very different approaches to what kind of country this should be, right? And so instead of having a national conversation about what kind of country this should be, and understanding that people vote on that question, we're talking about all this other stuff, right? And it's as if, you know, and somehow we manage to still trust our you know, history courses that explain what happened before 1930 and there was polling, when apparently, like, there were other causes of winning and losing elections, right? And, you know, God help us if we'd had polling for in the 1860s and that we thought that was, we were divided because the of all the resentment against high school graduates in the North, rather than about the expansion of enslaving human beings, right? And we're kind of, but that's what we're doing now. Instead of talking about a society where people have civil and human rights and the possibility of economic flourishing, like, we're like talking about it the way we are.
I really appreciate you taking all the time with me to do this. We're going to check in again with you about a lot of this stuff, because I think your point about where the focus is really the key to the election. Mike Podhorser, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. If you want more podcasts from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber, which gives you access to our new podcast, The Editor's Roundtable. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman. Thank you, and I'll talk to you soon.